And will you please turn to 2 Kings chapter 25, page 351 in the Old Testament section of the Bible in front of you. 2 Kings chapter 25, because we're going to be homing in on some of those verses in that chapter. I think that even a cursory casting of our eyes down and across world history leaves us surprised and staggered and reeling as we see what has occurred. So Egypt, the Assyrian Empire, Nebuchadnezzar at Babylon, the Persian Empire, the Islamic Empire, at one stage touched southern France, central Europe, Africa and Asia. But there's been a great disintegration from what they were. Or more recently, consider Napoleon. He made France the most feared nation of Europe in the early 1800s. Or think about Hitler. He boasted he'd build a 1,000-year Reich, but actually he saw it shattered in a decade. Or think of Imperial Japan. It absorbed most of East Asia in the 1930s, but was brought to its knees. Or think of a former Soviet Union, splintered. The dream ended for each of these powerful nations. You may remember 1987 saw the publication of a book called The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers. It was a book which got quite a lot of attention. It was written by Paul Kennedy, the Yale University professor. And it was Kennedy who coined the term imperial overstretch to describe the way in which powerful nations fall. And what caused a lot of attention is what he said about the USA, because he suggested that the USA might be the latest victim of this disease. He wrote this: "The sum total of the United States' global interest and obligation is nowadays far larger than the country's power to defend them all simultaneously." And that may be so. But in 2 Kings chapter 25, it's not imperial overstretch, but the ignoring of God, the disobeying of his commands, and the sitting loose to his covenant, which brought Judah to a fatal spiritual flabbiness. It had all started so well with such promise and progress, but then came the end of the dream. Would you please notice first of all that an awful situation occurs? Over the last 7 weeks we've been working through 1 and 2 Kings, and we've seen the pace of dissolution speeding up and continue unabated, except for a few exemplary kings who temporarily slowed things down. And the effect of ignoring God has snowballed down the years. But we now come to the avalanches of two brutal, punitive Babylonian invasions. And in reading 2 Kings chapter 25, the smoking ruins of Jerusalem are not hard to recreate in our imagination, because the author lays before us in graphic detail the dismantling of the nation of Judah. But you and I are liable to miss the full awful situation which confronted Judah with its defeat and exile, unless we dig beneath the surface and see how the nation of Judah was dismantled so very completely. The writer of Kings sketches for us the promise dismantled by showing us the sacred places being violated. The land, the city, the temple are all violated and lost. But worse still occurs, because it's not just the sacred places, but God's chosen people, the sacred people, who are violated. And it's absolutely devastating. Kingship is removed, the priests go, the officials are removed and destroyed. Let's examine the enormity of this violation and see just how awful the situation was. There's the land, the promised land promised to Moses and Israel back in Exodus chapter 23, which is now overrun and wrenched from Judah's control. Indeed, archaeology has shown that no town in Judah was continuously occupied throughout the exilic period. You see, the promise of the land was dismantled. Then there's the city. Look down to chapter 25 and verse 10, because there we read this: And all the army of the Chaldeans, who were with the captain of the guard, broke down the walls around Jerusalem. The large and extensive walls of Jerusalem were burnt and demolished. And of course, Jerusalem, in losing her walls, effectively lost her status as a city. And then in verses 8 to 12, we see that the city is systematically burned. The buildings, as well as the walls, are razed to the ground. The land, the city, dismantled. Then there's the temple also dismantled. One king started with the building of a temple, but it's now destroyed and burned. And the valuable parts of the temple are carried off as bullion and scrap bronze. And in verses 13 to 17, we see the temple plundered. And in fact, those verses are a deliberate echo of what is written in 1 Kings chapter 7 about the temple, to show what has happened to the temple at this stage. You see, the temple had witnessed to and spoken of the fact that God's dwelling place was now established among his people. It had pointed to a stability secured by his presence and his promise. Yes, the temple had had 420 years of varying fortune, but now it's destroyed and is in ashes. And the symbols that remain intact, the temple vessels and the king, are horror of horrors, not in Judah, but in Babylon. What has happened to the land, the city, and the temple is terrible. But there's more to come, because Nebuzaradan, whose title means chief executioner, captures the remaining religious, civil, and military personnel who remain in Jerusalem, and he executes them. What happens to Judah's kings? Well, look at verse 12, will you? Because there we read in chapter 24, verse 12, "And Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, gave himself up to the king of Babylon, and also his mother, the prince's servants and palace officials went as well." And then look to chapter 25, verses 4 to 7, because we read there that a breach was made in the city. The king with all the men of war fled by night by way of the gate between the two walls by the king's garden. So the Chaldeans were around the city, and they went in the direction of Araba. But the army of the Chaldeans pursued the king and overtook him in the plains of Jericho, and all his army was scattered from him. Verse 6, they captured the king and brought him up to the king of Babylon. And verse 7, they slew the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes, and put out the eyes of Zedekiah, and bound him in fetters, and took him to Babylon. You see, after a failed attempt to escape from Babylonian custody, Zedekiah is blinded and dragged off to exile after seeing his sons killed before him. The monarchy is maimed, in prison, and in exile, and is in reality dismantled. And with the monarchy shattered, everything else is going to go the same way. At verse 18 of chapter 25, what happens to the priests? Well, the captain of the guard took Sariah the chief priest and Zephaniah the second priest. What of the officials? Well, chapter 24, verses 14 to 16, shows all the skilled and youthful classes of Judah's society have been exiled. What are the people in general? Well, look at verse 11 of chapter 25. "And the rest of the people who were left in the city, and the deserters who deserted the king of Babylon, together with the rest of the multitude, were carried into exile." You see, the exile sweeps up the loyalist and the collaborator with the enemy, and so only the peasants are left. In verse 12 we read, "The captain of the guard left some of the poorest of the land to be vine dressers and ploughmen." But actually they serve as agricultural labourers in the Babylonian state service. And then the remainder of the people suffer further setbacks as their appointed governor, Gedaliah, is assassinated. It's an awful situation. It's an agonising destruction. But the magnitude of the severity of what has befallen Judah is spelt out even further by the writer of Kings. I wonder if you spotted it as it was read, because we see the chronology of Judah overwhelmed by the chronology of Babylon. And this change in chronology underscores the totality of the destruction of Judah's national life. The royal chronology continues with the last four kings of Judah, but in chapter 24, verse 12, Jehoiakim's surrender sees an alien chronology intrude itself, because there we read this: "And Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, gave himself up to the king of Babylon, himself and his mother and his servants and his princes and his palace officials. The king of Babylon took him prisoner in the eighth year of his reign." Previously, reigns had been calculated in terms of the kings of Judah. But now we have the solemn repetition of a foreign chronological formula in chapter 25, verse 1, 2, 3, and verse 8. You see, in the end, the chronology of Judah is overwhelmed by that of Babylon. But we also see that theologically the sky has fallen as far as salvation history is concerned, because after the Gedaliah episode we read in chapter 25 verse 26 this: "Then all the people, both small and great, and the captains of the forces arose and went to Egypt, for they were afraid of the Chaldeans." You see, the worst possible thing has happened. The exodus from Egypt has been undone. Again and again in 1 and 2 Kings, that great fact of God's rescue from Egypt is mentioned. It's the central act of God's rescue in history. But now, this saving event is reversed in a thudding anticlimax. You see, Israel had been given an open-ended choice. You may remember back in Deuteronomy chapter 30, verses 15 to 20, just scroll that down if you're taking notes. They'd been offered either life or death, and life if they followed God's commands and kept to the covenant. But now there's the worst possible outcome, because they've chosen death instead of life, and they experience the horrible curses mentioned in Deuteronomy chapter 28. They fall, those curses, on the king and nation. You see, in chapter 25, verse 26, the divine act which had made them God's people is reversed, and all hope is destroyed. Babylon has dismantled all Solomon had built, and Judah has no resources to rebuild herself. To Judah, it appeared to be total and a complete end, and the once great and proud Judah is no more. But let's move on. And second, will you notice that an ambiguous end occurs. A few years ago I was eastern Turkey, and I walked all night to reach a place high up in the mountains where there's going to be a wonderful view when the sun arose. We walked at such a good pace, we got there about an hour and a half before we needed to. And we sat there in the cold darkness waiting for the sun to rise. And staring into the dark, I, at one stage, became aware of a hint of amber in the cold grey dawn. But actually, as I sat there sort of shivering and peering into the darkness, I wondered whether it really was a hint of amber or whether I was imagining it. And it's rather like that with the ambiguity at the end of the Book of Kings. You see, the story of a nation has come to an end. The narrative has done everything it can to put to rest the false hope on the part of the exilic readers. And the only proper reaction seems to be that of Ezekiel. Ezekiel chapter 37 verse 11: "Our bones are dried up and our hope is lost. We're clean cut off." But look on to chapter 25 verse 27 onwards. "In the 37th year of the exile of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, in the 12th month, on the 27th day of the month, Evil-Merodach, king of Babylon, in the year that he began to reign, graciously freed Jehoiakim, king of Judah, from prison, and spoke kindly to him, and gave him a seat above the seats of the kings who were with him in Babylon. And it goes on and mentions how he was given a regular allowance. And that word freed in the Hebrew has the sense, the idea of lifting somebody's head. Because the head is a symbol of power and respect. And as that new king was inaugurated, well, what did he do? He had an amnesty. And Jehoiakim is rehabilitated. But actually, the end of 2 Kings is ambiguous. We wonder, don't we, does it give hope or merely underscore the situation with hopeless despair? There's Jehoiakim. He's in the Babylonian court. He's a puppet king with a meaningless throne. For verse 30 puts it, as long as he lived. But with that negative ending, when he died, all future hope of a Davidic monarchy is cut off. Others see in Evel Merodach's gracious words and actions a sign of better times to come. If you like, a sort of quasi-messianic expectation that David's line would one day reign again. And of course some of the temple utensils were intact, if in exile. It all looks like the last nail in Judah's coffin, and yet there's a hint of the first amber of dawn in the darkness. But let's move on, because third, an assured future is promised. In a monumental work, it was Professor Arnold Toynbee, in his book A Study of History, who posed the question, what lines of action are open to people who are aware of living in a declining civilization? And Toynbee suggested various ways forward, four possible ways forward. The first he called archaism. That is, in disgust with the sordid present, you idealise the good old days and try to bring them back. So the good old days before the war, or even the merry England of the medieval times. The second he called futurism. That's a way of revolution. You try to construct a socially and radically different situation from the present, and so different that it can only come by revolution. The third he called detachment, and that actually means you throw in the sponge and contract out all responsibility for a situation that's gone too far to return. And he says that many people take escape in using religion to remain in an entirely different other world. But the fourth thing Toynbee fascinatingly called transfiguration, and he defines it like this, I quote, "We bring the total situation as we ourselves partake in it into a larger context which gives it new meaning." At the end of 2 Kings, with the end of the dream, Christians must bring what we've read into its larger context, because only then is it given new meaning. Only then, to use Toynbee's phrase, is it transfigured. Only then do we see where history is leading. 2 Samuel 7 verse 16, God has made a promise to David. Your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever. And yet the exile and destruction of the temple seemed to have put an end to that promise that God would rule his people through the house of David. And yet, that promise of God was never revoked. It stood. I heard recently about a student up at Oxford. He was the prosperous, the eldest son of a peer of the realm. And this particular peer of the realm was very right-wing and a racist. And at the end of the term, the student wrote home like this, "My dear mother and father, I'm so sorry I've not written. It's been a difficult third term. I had a fire in my rooms. I lost everything, but was able to break a window and jump out. But I broke both legs, which are now in plaster. However, I have met a gorgeous African girl, and we're getting married in a fortnight." And the letter carried on. The last page letter said this, "Perhaps this news is worrying you. But don't worry, I've only failed my exams, and I wanted to help you to get everything into perspective." And you and I need to look to Jesus Christ to get 2 Kings chapter 25 into perspective. a Davidic king never reigned in Jerusalem again. The promise of an eternal Davidic dynasty points straight out into the void. It was unfulfilled in any political sense. And yet in that most Jewish gospel, Matthew chapter 1 verse 12, we have Jesus Christ mentioned, who in verse 12 is a direct descendant of Jehoiakim. Jesus Christ is born in Bethlehem. The wise men come to him and say, "Where is he who's born king of the Jews?" They want to worship this king. And Matthew, in quoting Micah 2 verse 6, says, "And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means the least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who will govern my people Israel." Later on, Jesus, in entering Jerusalem in Matthew 21, acts out a royal role. You see, it's in Jesus Christ, as Matthew reminds us so powerfully, that actually David's throne is established forever. It all seemed like the end of a dream, but actually it found an assured future in Jesus Christ. He was the one who then and now can make sense of the end of a dream. As we end, let me give you two areas for you to ponder over the coming week, because the books of Kings contain a great warning. There's a certain part of the river which rushes with increasing speed towards the Niagara Falls, and one part of the bank is known as Past Redemption Point. And once that point is passed, no effort by rowers can pull a boat upstream again. And from Solomon to the exile, God was faithful in his promise and his warning. And the living God is a God who pleads with us. But when he's whetted his sword in judgment, he doesn't turn. And that's why we have this disastrous end to national life for Judah. And if you and I scorn him and his word, judgment will come with terrible consequences. You see, judgment and hell are as real as salvation and heaven. And failure to take account of these great facts, to take account of the living God, will push you and I beyond redemption's point, with terrible, inevitable results. But the book of Kings is also ambiguous at the end. And in that way, it's a great encouragement, because the God of the Bible is the God of surprises and the God of amazing grace. And how privileged you and I are to be sitting in church this morning, where actually we can rejoice in and see the arrival of a king who is our righteousness, who endured an exile for us. He knew what it was to be separated from God on the cross. And that separation wasn't for his own sins, but for ours. And so a new Israel is created, and King Jesus reigns forever and ever. That's something you and I should rejoice in constantly. Let's pause for a prayer. Almighty God, we tremble as we see the end of that dream, and your justice and your judgment come down upon Judah. And yet, thank you so much that you're not just a God of judgment, but a God who does the surprising, who meets us with amazing grace. And how we want to thank you that that is true today for anyone who will turn to Christ. Help us, Lord, to rejoice in that, to live under this glorious message and obey it. Amen.